Stone, Rolling Stone. Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Stone, wanna buy 5 copies for our mother? Yeah. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading today from a special collector's edition of Rolling Stone, entitled Bob Dylan, The Complete Album Guide. We'll start with the introduction by John Dolan. Try to be a little different on every album, Bob Dylan told Rolling Stone editor Jan S. Wenner in 1969 when he sat down for his first interview with the magazine. That's putting it lightly. In the 55 years since his self-titled 1962 debut, Dylan has released 36 albums, 10 of which are on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time, and worn almost too many stylistic guises to keep straight. From the protest folk radical of 1964's The Times They Are A-Changin', to the gale force rocker of 1965's Highway 61 Revisit, and 1966's Blonde on Blonde, to the confessional poet of 1975's Blood on the Tracks, to the roots-tugging song and dance man of 2001, Love and Theft. He's tried his hand at everything from gospel to country to Christmas music to pre-rock standards, scandalizing purists and sometimes confusing even devoted fans, but always keeping us waiting for his next revolution. Rolling Stone has been chronicling that epic emergence since the magazine began publishing in 1967. For this special collector's issue, we tell the stories behind the making of his studio album. To get those stories, we've tapped our archive of interviews and features from throughout his career and the massive library of Dylan histories and biographies. We've also conducted new interviews with peers like David Crosby, Roger McGuinn, and Emmylou Harris, veterans of his most famous sessions like Al Kooper, who was a key player on Dylan's best 60s work, and Daniel Lanois, the U2 producer who helped Dylan begin a late career rejuvenation with 1989's Oh Mercy and 1997's Time Out of Mind. If it's not a fucking masterpiece, Lanois said of his attitude toward working with Dylan, get the fuck out of my face. If Dylan has come up with masterpiece after masterpiece, he's had his legendary low points too. But even his failures come with great story, like the moment during the laborious making of 1985's mall pop misfire, Empire Burlesque, when producer Arthur Baker looked over to see Dylan distractedly strumming his guitar and singing Madonna's Like a Virgin. Can we make a record like Prince and Madonna? Dylan asked. Maybe someday. As a singer, Dylan changed music forever by putting personal expression ahead of mere vocal talent. In an insightful tribute essay, Bono explores Dylan's vocal legacy. He was the voice of a generation, Bono writes. Then he became the voice of all the generation. That voice has been so tireless that even his less beloved albums have superb songs, so critic Bob Sheffield has put together a list of his 20 greatest forgotten classics. To navigate the seemingly endless supply of Dylan's official and unofficial bootleg material, our chief on-staff Dylanologist, Andy Green, has compiled a guide to the best of these releases. The further you get into Dylan, the deeper the mystery gets. For 3 weeks in Paris, we didn't stop playing it, John Lennon once said in describing the Beatles' first mind-blowing exposure to Dylan's landmark 1963 album, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. We all went potty about Dylan. In 2017, we still are. We'll start with Bob Dylan's first album, entitled Bob Dylan. That was released March 19, 1962. This article by Douglas Wolfe. On his debut album, Dylan was finding his voice and planting the seeds of future triumphs. Bob Dylan moved from Minnesota to New York in January 1961 with the goal of earning a reputation in the folk music scene. Right away, he started making a name for himself. Dylan befriended his idol Woody Guthrie. By April, he was opening for blues legend John Lee Hooker. By September, he was the subject of a rapturous New York Times review. In November, he was going into the studio to make his first album for Columbia Records. All of that, though, didn't translate to having an audience. When Dylan played Carnegie Chapter Hall, a few weeks before he recorded Bob Dylan, there were only 53 attendees. At the time, Dylan was still discovering his creative voice as he devoured folk and blues records, grabbed tunes from his contemporaries, and worked up his stage persona. He also hadn't yet made his bones as a songwriter. At the Bob Dylan sessions, overseen by legendary A&R man John Hammond, who signed him, only 4 of the 17 songs he played were originals. Only 2 of those 4 made the cut for the final record, and both of those 2 were deeply indebted to Guthrie. "The producer asked me to make an album by myself," Dylan said in a 1962 interview. "There was a violent, angry emotion running through me then. I don't know why. I just played guitar and harmonica and sang those songs, and that was it." He wasn't entirely by himself in the studio, though. His girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, was present, and he used her lipstick holder as a slide on In My Time of Dying. Bob Dylan is clearly the work of a young artist who's got astonishing gifts, even if he hasn't quite figured out what he wants to do with them. When Bob first started playing in coffee houses, he was an incomparable performer of traditional music, says guitarist David Bromberg, an early associate of Dylan's who went on to record with him several times. "I mean, he was really spectacular." Dylan told Hammond that the material he recorded for the album was "some stuff I've written, some stuff I've discovered, some stuff I stole," as if there were no real distinction between these categories. In fact, his high-octane performances blurred the lines between some very different bodies of music, including Scottish balladry on Pretty Peggy O, New York folk scene standards like the Appalachian tune Man of Constant Sorrow, 20s Texas blues, Blind Lemon Jefferson's See That My Grave Is Kept Clean, and even the work of his contemporary. The album's opening track, You're No Good, was written by Jesse Fuller, a Bay Area one-man band who didn't even record it himself until 1963. As Dylan put it in 1984, "When I started, I combined other people's styles unconsciously. I wasn't as good technically as, say, Eric Darling of the Weavers or Tom Paley of the New Lost City Ramblers, so I had to take the songs and make them mine in a different way. It was the early folk music done in a rock way, which was the first kind of music I played." By the time Bob Dylan was released in March 1962, Dylan had started writing songs in earnest. "That's not me," he said in August 1963 about his debut. "There was only a couple of my stories on." The album was a commercial bomb initially, but the Greenwich Village folk scene took notice of the rising star in its midst. "He was on Columbia Records, and that was a big deal," says Minnesota folk artist Tony Glover, a peer of Dylan's early on. "As far as I was concerned, he'd made it." Dylan's next album was the Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. This was released on May 27th of 1963. This is an article by Alan Light. "Dylan broke with folk orthodoxy, recorded his own songs, and made his first classic. I wrote a lot of songs in a quick amount of time," said Dylan of the creative explosion that resulted in his second album, 1963's The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. "I could do that then because the process was new to me. I felt like I'd discovered something no one else had ever discovered. And I was in a sort of an arena artistically that no one else had ever been in before." Dylan's second LP was not only his first genuine masterpiece, it was also a landmark in the very way that popular music was created. After writing just 2 songs on his 1962 debut, he wrote 12 of the 13 songs on Freewheelin', including such classics as Blowin' in the Wind, A Hard Rain's A-Gonna Fall, and Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, permanently altering the relationship between singer and songwriter. And he did so with a collection of compositions that displayed a dizzying range, from blistering social commentary, tackling such topics as civil rights and nuclear holocaust, to nuanced romance, from comic-talking blues to melancholy heartbreak. When the Beatles were first given the album by a French DJ, they could listen to little else. "For 3 weeks in Paris, we didn't stop playing it," said John Lennon. "We all went potty about Dylan." Unlike his debut LP, and unlike most of his albums to follow, Freewheelin' was a project that Dylan, just 20 years old when recording began, took his time with, where Bob Dylan was cut in just 2 days. This album was crafted over no fewer than 8 separate visits to the studio, spanning a full year from April 1962 to April 1963. Over the course of those months, he continued to revise and refine the song selection, trying desperately to keep up with the breathtaking, high-speed evolution of his songwriting. Though the world didn't know it yet, Dylan had been writing songs nonstop since arriving in New York in 1961. "He was writing all the time, at night sitting in the clubs," says Peter Yarrow. "You'd see him reading a newspaper, and then the next day he wrote a song about what he had read." The album was also informed by the constant influx of new experiences and ideas affecting Dylan at the time: a burgeoning political awareness, his first trip overseas, the entrance of Albert Grossman as his manager. Above all, though, Freewheelin' revealed the impact of his girlfriend, Susie Rotolo, depicted huddling with Dylan on a snow-covered Jones Street for the album's iconic cover. "The cover's the most important part of the album," he would say to his friends. Rotolo was studying art in Italy during most of the album's creation, and Dylan's longing, even his anger during her absence, impacted many of these songs. Also crucial was the effect of Rotolo's activist family on Dylan's worldview. Both of her parents were members of the American Communist Party. "Susie was into this equality freedom thing long before I was," he said. In April, just a month after the release of his debut, Dylan first entered Columbia's Studio A in New York to start work on an album then being called Bob Dylan's Blues. Over the course of 2 days, he demonstrated his intent to build an album around his own writing, recording 8 new original compositions, along with several traditional folk songs and numbers by Hank Williams and Robert Johnson. He returned to the studio July 9th, recording the loose, absurd Bob Dylan's Blues, Down the Highway, which included the only explicit reference to Rotolo's travel. "My baby took my heart from me. She packed it all up in a suitcase. Lord, she took it away to Italy, Italy. And honey, just allow me one more chance." Most notably, though, in this session he recorded a song that he had debuted at Gertie's Folk City in April, built on the melody of the old spiritual No More Auction Block, a song titled Blowin' in the Wind. The simple majesty of the lyrics, a series of imagistic questions that added up to a forceful plea for common sense, justice, and equality, was unprecedented. The first way to answer these questions in the song is by asking them, he told Nat Hentoff for the album's liner notes, but lots of people have to first find the wind. Grossman played a demo of the song for his clients Peter, Paul, and Mary. "I immediately said, this is it. This is the anthemic song," says Peter Yarrow. "It was such a breakthrough. It was absolutely astonishing." Peter, Paul, and Mary would release Blowin' in the Wind as a single 3 weeks after Freewheelin' came out. It sold 300,000 copies in the first week of release, and it peaked at number 2 on the Billboard chart. More recording sessions in October and November illustrated that Dylan still hadn't settled on the proper shape for the album. He tried a new direction, recording with a full band in a style that flirted with rockabilly, almost 3 full years before going electric. The only tracks that ultimately made it to Freewheel were his rewrite of the Mississippi Sheik's Carina Carina and the breezily bitter Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, written after he heard from Rotolo that she was considering extending her stay in Italy. "It isn't a love song," Dylan told Hentoff. "It's a statement that maybe you can say to make yourself feel better." 3 more keepers were added on December 6th as the album was finally starting to come into focus. Oxford Town was an account of James Meredith's ordeal as the first black student enrolled at the University of Mississippi. And I Shall Be Free was a bit of a throwaway, a rewrite of Lead Belly's We Shall Be Free. This session also yielded the album's greatest moment, the brilliant epic, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, based on the melody and structure of the British folk ballad Lord Randall. Dylan had premiered the song at Carnegie Hall on September 22nd, but exactly 1 month later, President Kennedy announced the discovery of Soviet missiles in Cuba, prompting the Cuban Missile Crisis. Never one to miss a chance for some self-mythologizing, Dylan told Hentoff that Hard Rain was written as a response to the threat of apocalypse. "Every line in it is actually the start of a whole new song. but when I wrote it, I thought I wouldn't have enough time alive to write all these songs, so I put all I could into this one. Allen Ginsberg said that when he first heard the song, he wept with joy because it seemed that the torch had been passed to another generation from early bohemian or beat illumination and self-empowerment. As he kept working, Dylan told friends that he still wasn't satisfied with where the album was going. "There's too many old-fashioned songs in there, stuff I tried to write like Woody," he said. "I'm going through changes, need some more finger-pointing songs in it, because that's where my head's at right now." The first manifestation was the scathing anti-military industrial complex attack, Masters of War. In April 1963, he got this new batch of songs recorded. Girl from the North Country was a wistful love song seemingly inspired by old girlfriends Echo Hellstrom and Bonnie Beecher, as much as his recent yearnings for Rotolo, who had just returned to New York. Bob Dylan's Dream also had a nostalgic streak, reflecting on friendships and a community that perhaps Dylan sensed would be forever altered after this album came out. "We were just kids," says Yarrow. "We were just putting one foot in front of the other, thinking about what we were going to have for dinner. I remember Bobby had this bullwhip, and we would go out on the street and practice cracking the whip." Bob Dylan's Dream really captures all that. Those songs weren't initially part of the freewheeling Bob Dylan, though. They were included later when Dylan got a chance to revise the album, most likely in response to his label's demand that he remove the potentially libelous Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues. Regardless of the chronology, the result was an album that was better rounded and more fully realized, replacing the reverence of more traditional folk blues with greater levity and depth. Not that all of his earlier fans were ready to follow him. "The album floats away into Never Never Land, a failure," wrote his Minnesota friends in the folk purist journal, The Little Sandy Review. But around the world, the reverberations of the freewheeling Bob Dylan were enormous. In Winnipeg, Manitoba, a kid named Neil Young heard the album and, as with so many others, considered entirely new possibilities for his life. "I just said, hey, there's a guy who sounds different doing his thing too. I really like this guy. I can write songs." Dylan's next album, released in January of 1964, was The Times They Are a Change. This article is by John Dolan. In the year he played the March on Washington, Dylan made his most political album. In the fall of 1963, Minnesota folk musician Tony Glover visited Dylan at his New York apartment. "He had a work table," says Glover, "like a plank or a door on a sawhorse kind of thing. Some lyrics were laying there and the phrase, 'Come, senators, congressmen, please heed the call.' I kind of saw it and went, 'What the hell is this?' It struck me as tract right." Dylan's response, as Glover recalls it, was simple. "People like this sort of thing." The song in question, The Times They Are a-Changin', and the album of the same name, marked the height of Dylan's role as protest artist. "I wanted to write a big song in a simple way," he said years later. It was the first album Dylan recorded to solely feature songs he'd written. That summer, he'd played in front of 200,000 people at the March on Washington and made his first trip to the Deep South, performing alongside Pete Seeger at a concert at the edge of a cotton field, a few miles outside Greenwood, Mississippi. Among the songs he played that day was the searing, "Only a Pawn in Their Game," about the assassination of NAACP field officer Medgar Evers. Racist violence was the theme of another of the Times They Are a-Changin's most harrowing song, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, a gripping, if largely inaccurate, retelling of a black hotel maid's murder at the hands of a wealthy white man, based on a newspaper article Dylan had read. Other songs that ended up on the album, Talkin' World War III Blues, and the instant folk standard, With God on Our Side, had geopolitical overtones. Dylan had to explain to his Russian father that the latter's song, Cold War parody lyrics, were sarcastic. Work on the album began with producer Tom Wilson in August 1963 and was completed by late October, with a brief break to play some shows with Joan Baez. Not every song was topical. The somber ballads, One Too Many Mornings, and Boots of Spanish Leather tapped a richly intimate and poetic sense of longing, one of the album's most beloved songs, When the Ship Comes In. blurred the personal and political, the apocalyptic anthem contained one of Dylan's most prophetic-sounding lyrics, "The whole wide world is watching." But it was inspired less by world events than by an incident in which he was barred entrance into a posh hotel because of his shabby appearance. In truth, though, his ship was just setting sail. Dylan's next album was entitled Another Side of Bob Dylan, which was released in August of 1964. This is an article by David Brown. His days of writing finger-pointing songs behind him, Dylan's ambition exploded. It was June 1964, and folk singer Ramblin' Jack Elliott was standing in front of the Folklore Center in Greenwich Village. A car pulled up and Dylan popped out, just back from a trip to Europe. At first, Elliott didn't recognize his old friend. For one thing, he was taller, thanks to what Elliott calls boots of Spanish leather with high heel. But Elliott realized it was Dylan after all. "Why don't you come with us?" Dylan beckoned. "We're getting ready to go uptown to do some recording. Get in the car." Elliott obliged, and soon enough, they arrived at Columbia Records' Midtown studio. Dylan hadn't recorded any music for the label since the previous October, a veritable lifetime during a period when artists would pump out two or three releases of new material a year, and the time had come to make a new album. Elliott carried a couple of bottles of Beaujolais in from the car and joined a bustling crew of friends and colleagues, producer Tom Wilson, journalist Al Aronowitz, and others, as they gathered around to watch Dylan, in jeans and at times wearing sunglasses, cut his fourth album. "We're going to make a good one tonight," he told Wilson. "I promise." It would certainly be an atypical one for Dylan. He'd recently broken up with girlfriend Susie Rotolo, and the new songs that poured out him, some written during vacation time in Greece and Paris, where he visited after playing London's Royal Festival Hall in May, reflected those life changes. There were love songs alternately frisky, like All I Really Want to Do, bittersweet, like It Ain't Me, Babe, or Ballad in Plain D, and scathing, I Don't Believe You, She Acts Like We Never Have Met. In an homage to the past that only insiders would know, the album's cover photo featured Dylan wearing jeans that Rotolo had cut to fit over his boots. The lyric sheets Dylan propped up on his music stand at Columbia Studio A also included surrealistic talking blues like I Shall Be Free No. 10, Motorpsycho Nightmare, and a wistful old soul ballad, My Back Pages, that housed one of his most poignant refrains, "I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now." As Dylan told writer Nat Hendhoff, who was observing the session, "There aren't any finger-pointing songs. You know, pointing to all the things that are wrong. Me, I don't want to write for people anymore. You know, be a spokesman." That night, the Columbia studio was hardly tranquil. Dylan's friends drank and talked, and three children ran around, Dylan teasing one of them with a good-natured, "I'm gonna rub you out." But Columbia needed a new album for the fall. Over the next 6 hours, Dylan, accompanying himself on guitar or piano, worked his way through different takes on all the material, including his first recorded piano tune, Black Crow Blues. He also tried out a new song, Mr. Tambourine Man, that he premiered at the London show. Spontaneously, he invited Elliott, who'd heard someone else sing the song but didn't know any of the lyrics, to sing it with him. Most of the songs he was recording, he was reading off a typewritten sheet, Elliott recalls, but this one he didn't need the sheet because he'd memorized it. Under the circumstances, Elliott did the best he could and made up a harmony that was game but off-key. That version ultimately wasn't used. Dylan would recut it for his next album, Bringing It All Back Home. Even without Mr. Tambourine Man or another outtake, Mama, You've Been On My Mind, the album was clearly a turning point for Dylan and his writing. "I thought, okay, that's more like," says musician and Dylan pal Tony Glover. "I thought it was more of what he was capable of, and it was good that he was doing that rather than being a spokesman for this group of people who had these axes to grind. It was good to see him using some of the poetic and surrealistic imagery." That was definitely the case with Spanish Harlem Incident, where Dylan asks a gypsy girl, "Come and take me into reach of your rattling drum." When Dylan finished recording it, he asked a friend in the studio if he understood it. When the friend nodded, Dylan responded, "I didn't." Only one song in the album vaguely fit the protest music mold, and it was more elliptical than specific. Chimes of Freedom was written around the time of a cross-country road trip Dylan took in early 1964 with three friends. He played three shows along the way, and they partied in New Orleans. During their time in the South, Dylan was inspired by the changes taking place there to finish the anthemic song. Still, Chimes of Freedom was a far cry from the times they are a change. In To Ramona, he seemed to make a veiled allusion to his sense that his time as a spokesman was coming to an end. I'll forever talk to you, but soon my words, they would turn into a meaningless ring. As Jackson Browne said of the song, he's always an advocate for finding your own way. In a sign of the constricted way many of Dylan's fans saw him in 1964, even an album as cohesive and emotionally expressive as Another Side of Bob Dylan was viewed, shockingly, as a letdown. Unlike the two records before it, it failed to break into the top 40 and received mixed notices. Dylan himself wasn't thrilled with the title, which, he said, was the work of Wilson. I begged and pleaded with him not to do it. Dylan later said, "You know, I thought it was overstating the obvious. I knew I was going to have to take a lot of heat for a title like that, and it was my feeling that it wasn't a good idea coming after The Times They Are a-Changin'. It just wasn't right. It seemed like a negation of the past, which in no way was true." But the album would be a milestone for him. His declaration of independence from his protest song typecasting, and phase one of an exploratory period that would lead to places even he couldn't have imagined at the time. As he left the studio that night, he told Hentoff, "My background's not all that important, though. It's what I am now that counts." In March 1965, Dylan released Bringing It All Back Home, this article by Will Hermes. Dylan goes electric, invents folk rock, and redefines what can be said in a song. When Bob Dylan entered Columbia Records Studio A in mid-January 1965 and blew out an 11-song LP in 3 days, he didn't merely go electric, invent folk rock, and transition from an acoustic troubadour to a boundary-pushing rock and roller. He conjured performances that would completely reimagine how pop music communicated, not just what it could say, but how it could say it. "Some people say that I'm a poet," he wrote coyly in the prose poem notes on the back cover. Now, he was ready to test the limits of what that meant, rewiring himself for a singularly revolutionary moment. The Fallout Shelter sign in the cover shot was on point. Bringing It All Back Home was the cultural equivalent of a nuclear bomb. The thing about bringing it all back home was his words, says David Crosby. That's what Bob stunned the world with. Up until then, we had Ooh Baby and I Love You Baby. Bob changed the map. He gave us really, really good work. As Dylan put in his memoir, Chronicle, "What I did to break away was to take simple folk changes and put new imagery and attitude to them, use catchphrases and metaphor combined with a new set of ordinances that evolved into something different that had not been heard before." Dylan had been considering his next artistic leap forward for some time, at least since early 1964, when he'd been bowled over by hearing the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand on the radio. "They were doing things nobody was doing," he recalled. "The chords were outrageous, just outrageous, and the harmonies made it all valid. You could only do that with other musicians." On January 13, 1965, the first day of sessions for the album, Dylan recorded solo and entirely acoustic, just as he always had, with a guitar, harmonica, and piano. Some believe the idea was to cut demos for an all-electric LP, but Dylan was clearly feeling out the best approach for each song. His instincts were shark-like. Subterranean Homesick Blues, Bob Dylan's 115th Dream, Love Minus Zero, No Limit, On the Road Again, and a variant of Outlaw Blues were recorded on that first day, in versions that have since surfaced. Within the next 48 hours, all those songs would be recut electric for the final release. That first session also included a run-through, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and the remarkably tender, I'll Keep It With Mine. The latter, which never made the album, was apparently written for Nico, the German actress and singer who, before her recruitment into the Velvet Underground, spent some quality time with Dylan in Greece. She would record the song for her solo debut, while Dylan's outtakes would surface on later compilations. That one of his greatest songs wound up in the outtakes pile is a sign of the fire Dylan was stoking. The next day, January 14th, producer Tom Wilson put together a group of musicians to take things to the next level, including bassist Bill Lee, father of filmmaker Spike Lee, who played on Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, drummer Bobby Gregg, pianist Paul Griffin, and at Dylan's behest, multi-instrumentalist Bruce Langhorne. Langhorne was the owner of the outsized Middle Eastern tambourine that inspired Mr. Tambourine Man, though he actually played electric guitar on the song. A month earlier, Wilson had tried unsuccessfully to overdub rock backing on three Dylan songs, including his version of The House of the Rising Sun. The technique would create a number one hit when Wilson added drums and keyboards to Simon & Garfunkel's folk-pop watershed, The Sound of Silence, later in 1965. For Dylan, playing with a live band worked better, and as the session got going, the songs coalesced quickly. Daniel Kramer, who took the iconic photo for the front cover of Bringin' It All Back Home, later recalled, "Most of the songs went down easily and needed only three or four takes. His method of working, the certainty of what he wanted, kept things moving." Dylan's growth as a lyricist is most visible on the largely acoustic Mr. Tambourine Man and the wholly unplugged It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. Both show his verbal flow exploding into dazzling shards of fevered image and abstraction. Tucked into the LP's second side, Mr. Tambourine Man was likely the album's first composition. Written partly in New Orleans, Dylan had debuted it at a Royal Festival Hall show the previous May. It's All Right, Ma, a tirade on poison culture, appeared on a Philadelphia stage in October. Dylan asserts that both songs were deeply influenced by Robert Johnson's blues lyrics and the twisted Brecht Weil narrative song Pirate Jenny. In fact, an album of Brecht Weil songs and a Johnson LP are among the records pictured in Dylan's room on the cover of Bringing It All Back Home. It's All Right, Ma is arguably the songwriter's greatest and darkest political song and one of his last. Dylan wrote it in the summer of 1964 in Woodstock, New York, while folk song peers Joan Baez and Richard and Mimi Farina were his house guests. In the studio, he knew it needed nothing but voice and acoustic guitar, and he nailed it quickly. Dylan had never sharpened his anger to greater effect, taking aim at loathsome consumer culture. Everything from toy guns that spark to flesh-colored Christs that glow in the dark. Advertising, propaganda, preachers, teachers, political parties, lemmings, functionaries, money, moralizing old lady judges, and the President of the United States. Yet, this was no finger-pointing Jeremiah. It was the sound of Dylan transitioning from the political writing that made him a generational prophet to a broader, more resigned vision. There is no sense in trying, it's life and life only. With its talk of a trip upon your magic swirling ship and of disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, the heady, loping Mr. Tambourine Man was pegged as a drug song. In 1964, Dylan had introduced the Beatles to pot in a New York hotel room. But that's a shallow reading of a song that is, at its core, a hymn to the power of music itself. He was singing some things that until then had just been confined to the page, says Dylan's Minnesota friend, folk musician Tony Glover, and it was kind of hair-raising. The Bringing It All Back Home version of the song came out after he ditched an earlier one cut the previous June for another side of Bob Dylan, although a new West Coast group called The Byrds heard that outtake and recorded their own abbreviated electric version. It was pretty awful, says Crosby of the Dylan outtake. We were able to take it and make a really great rock and roll record out of it. Ironically, the cover became Dylan's first number one pop hit when it was released in May 1965. He came to hear us in the studio when we were building The Byrds, recalls Crosby. After the word got out that we were going to do Tambourine Man, and we were probably going to be good, he came there and he heard us playing his song Electric, and you could see the gears grinding in his head. It was as plain as day. It was like watching a slow-motion lightning bolt. But if the Bird's Tidy Vision of folk rock launched a radio-ready subgenre, Dylan had much bigger ambitions. The boozy, sneering, electric blues spiel of Subterranean Homesick Blue, borrowing flows from Chuck Berry's Too Much Monkey Business and scat songs of the 40s, as Dylan admits, would open the record with a blast of R&B swagger and a fire hydrant outpour of verses. It was an immediate line in the sand. The first rap record, says Glover. But that was just the start. She Belongs to Me and Love Minus Zero No Limit are shimmeringly intimate love song. Bob Dylan's 115th Dream and On the Road Again, brilliantly funny lyrical bug outs. Outlaw Blues, a raw blues with a wink of autobiography. He had a lot of balls, recalled Kenny Rankin, a guitarist who played on the album. It was quite a thing just for Dylan to pick up an electric guitar. On the final day, Dylan and the musicians were in the zone. They'd knocked out Maggie's Farm, a raging protest rocker, in one take, and he did the same solo with Gates of Eden, a song at once baffling and undeniable. I'm not even sure what the song was about, Glover said, but I like the way it feels. Dylan also got final takes of Mr. Tambourine Man, It's All Right, Ma, and It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, one of the finest kiss-off songs ever recorded, and a contender for Dylan's prettiest song. Baby Blue reads as a barbed fare-thee-well to a lover, but also to Dylan's old core audience. It was an acoustic song, just guitar and harmonica, excepting the beautiful forward-tugging counter-melody played on electric bass by Bill Lee. But its heart was rooted in the rock and roll. I'd carried that song around in my head for a long time, Dylan said. When I was writing it, I remembered a Gene Vincent song. Of course, I was singing about a different Baby Blue. Another instant classic, it would be covered by the Grateful Dead, Van Morrison, Brian Ferry, and many others. Decades later, in Chronicles, Dylan would reflect on the writing of Gates of Eden and the other songs of this era. They were written under different circumstances, and circumstances never repeat themselves. Not exactly. I couldn't get to those kinds of songs anymore. To do it, you've got to have power and dominion over the spirits. I had done it once, and once was enough. Next, we have Dylan's landmark album, Highway 61 Revisited, which was released in August of 1965. This article is by Joe Levy. The album that destroyed folk music and set a mind-bending new standard for 60s rock. Bob Dylan's second album of 1965, Highway 61 Revisited, would be a historic break. For the first time, none of the tracks would feature just him and his guitar. On May 10th, Dylan finished the brief tour of England, 8 all-acoustic shows, chronicled in D.A. Pennebaker's documentary, Don't Look Back. By now, he was bored just playing his old songs as he'd recorded them. I was playing a lot of songs I didn't want to play, he'd say afterward. It's very tiring other people tell you how much they dig you, if you yourself don't dig you. Before long, he would bring that fight to his audience, some of whom would fight back at first, making music that embraced chaos and inspired. Everything was moving fast for Dylan. Although he brought Joan Baez along on the UK tour, he was already living at New York's Chelsea Hotel with Sarah Lowndes, who he'd marry in a private and, in fact, secret ceremony in November 1965. Adding to the blur, and no doubt the disconnection, was Dylan's amphetamine use. They were all so fucking high, remembered Marianne Faithfull, part of an ever-changing cast of characters in Dylan's suite at London's Savoy Hotel that included Donovan and Allen Ginsberg. Every 5 minutes or so, someone would go into the bathroom and come out speaking in tongues. On May 12th, 2 days after a show at the Royal Albert Hall, Dylan marked the end of the tour by booking a London session with John Mayall's Bluesbreakers, featuring a 20-year-old Eric Clapton on guitar, at Levy's recording studio. It did not go well. He was sitting at a piano and we just joined in, Clapton said. It was just a jam session. They played for 2 hours without getting anywhere. You're playing too much blues, man, Bobby Newhart told Clapton. He needs to be more country. Dylan would tell Michael Bloomfield more or less the same thing a month later. Bloomfield, the guitarist in the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, met Dylan in Woodstock the weekend before a June 15th session, a newly purchased Fender Telecaster. Said Dylan, a really good guitar for the first time in my life, in hand. Dylan wanted to teach Bloomfield the songs they'd be working on. One had been condensed from a recent amphetamine-fueled go at writing a book. Dylan would later describe it as a long piece of vomit, 10 or 20 pages long, just a rhythm thing on paper, all about my steady hatred, directed at some point that was on. It was based around the chord changes to Ritchie Valens' La Bamba and was called Like a Rolling Stone. I figure he wanted blues, string bending, because that's what I do, Bloomfield remembered. He said, "Hey man, I don't want any of that B.B. King stuff." Dylan had a sound in mind, and the following Tuesday, when they got to Columbia's Studio A in New York, Bloomfield functioned as more or less the musical director, he has said. Producer Tom Wilson had gathered some of the studio musicians who'd worked on Bringing It All Back Home, keyboardist Paul Griffin, drummer Bobby Gregg, and possibly guitarist Bruce Langhorne as well, and they started with 10 takes of a jumping version of It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry, then called Phantom Engineer, and moved on to 6 passes through a rocker packed with punchlines called Sitting on a Barbed Wire Fence. The results issued on The Bootleg Series Volumes 1 to 3 and the soundtrack to No Direction Home show how the sound of Highway 61 Revisited came together. If Dylan's acoustic guitar served as the jumping-off point for the music on Bringing It All Back Home, here was Bloomfield's electric, which references the blues, but reaches out to country twang and rockabilly snap. But when they moved on to Like a Rolling Stone, the 5 takes they tried didn't gel. "The voice is gone, man," Dylan said after the 4th take. When they returned the next day, 21-year-old Al Cooper had bluffed his way into the session. Cooper was a guitarist, but he sat himself at the organ, which he says he faked his way through like a kid fumbling for a light switch, and wound up on the song. Highway 61 was an unprofessional situation, he says today, exemplified by how I ended up playing on it. With Cooper supplying a bed of organ and Griffin at the piano, it took 2 rehearsals and 4 takes for Like a Rolling Stone to come together, though they kept going through 11 more takes, still searching as if unaware of the history they'd made. No one was unaware for long. The single was released on July 20. Initial copies sent to radio split the 6-minute song between 2 sides of a 45, but listeners demanded the whole song and they got it. "It seemed to go on and on forever," Paul McCartney remembered of hearing it at John Lennon's house. "It was just beautiful. He showed all of us that it was possible to go a little further." Just 5 days after Like a Rolling Stone was released, with the song burning up the radio, Dylan appeared at the Newport Folk Festival with an electric band. There is some lingering debate about the reaction. Were the boos that greeted their versions of Maggie's Farm, Like a Rolling Stone, and Phantom Engineer because the music was a shock, because there wasn't enough volume for the audience to hear it, or because there was too much volume? But there was no mistaking Dylan's intention. "Dylan wore rock and roll clothes," Bloomfield said. "Black leather, yellow pin shirt without a tie, and he had a Fender Stratocaster. He looked like someone from West Side Story." 4 days later, that Street Fighter was back at Studio A, running down the rest of the songs for Highway 61 in just 4 days. In the producer's chair was Bob Johnston. Wilson, who'd overseen Dylan's previous 3 albums, was gone. Why has never been fully explained, though Johnston pointed to tension between Wilson and Dylan's manager, Albert Grossman. Johnston would be at the helm for Highway 61 and the 5 albums that followed it. A July 29th session began with Tombstone Blues, a rollicking showcase for Bloomfield's guitar that invoked the ghost of Belle Starr, a Wild West outlaw queen sometimes called the female Jesse James. They proceeded with It Takes a Lot to Laugh, which began at the rocking pace of Tombstone Blues, until Dylan sat at the piano and reworked it into the sweeter, slower version on the album. Then came Dylan's next single, what many felt was his retort to the boos at Newport and the reaction of folky purists to his electric music, Positively 4th Street. Some of Dylan's most acidic put-downs, "You Have No Faith to Lose and You Know It," floated on Cooper's roller rink organ, and stabs of guitar outrage from Bloomfield. Issued as a non-LP single on September 7th, it would follow Like a Rolling Stone up the Billboard Hot 100, peaking at number 7. Dylan and Cooper spent the first weekend of August in Woodstock. They worked on chord charts for the songs they'd take up on Monday. That session began at 8 in the evening, and they homed in on what would become the album's title track, Highway 61 Revisited. The song took off with a gallop and one other thing, a police whistle that Cooper had brought to the session. "That was my fault," Cooper said. "At the time, I wore that police whistle around my neck like a necklace. I would use it in certain situations, mostly relating to drugs. My sense of humor at the time. When we were recording the song, it just sounded great to me. I took the necklace and put it around Bob's neck and said, 'Play this instead of the harmonica,' and there you go. And I think he kept it, damn it." The sessions continued with Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, which needed 16 takes to get that lost in the rain feeling. Clinton Halen believes one contributing factor may have been the studio musicians. Sam Lay of the Butterfield Blues Band began the sessions on drums, and Frank Owens on piano. But as the evening wore on, it seems, Greg took over on drums and Griffin at piano, and their touch was more in keeping with the exhausted feeling of the song. Queen Jane approximately followed in 7 takes, and then at 2 in the morning came the session's quickest song, and perhaps its crowning glory, Ballad of a Thin Man. A phantasmagoric carnival ride, it appears to take shape around Ray Charles' Ballad of Betrayal. "I believe to my soul you're trying to make a fool of me." It came together fast. It required just a false start and one run-through to get to the final take. As dawn broke on August 3rd, there were complete takes of all 9 songs for Highway 61 Revisited, as well as Dylan's next single. But he scheduled a session for August 4th to take another pass at the album closer, Desolation Row, just him and acoustic guitar. It might have stayed that way, except that Johnston had an ace up his sleeve. Nashville picker Charlie McCoy, who overdubbed the distinctive guitar part that gives the song its Mexican cantina flavor. When Dylan took the album on the road, he'd call it vision music and mathematical music, though he neglected to specify if it laid out the problem, the solution, or both. "I like the song. I like what I'm doing now," Dylan told Nora Ephron and Susan Edmiston at the time of Highway 61 Revisited's August 30th release. "They can boo until the end of time. I know that the music is real, more real than the boos." Dylan followed with the blockbuster album Blonde on Blonde, released in May of 1966, this by John Dolan. Hitting a creative peak, Dylan went to Nashville and made rock's first great double album. "I was going at a tremendous speed at the time of my Blonde on Blonde album," Bob Dylan told Rolling Stone editor and publisher Jan S. Wenner in 1969. On Blonde on Blonde, all the tension and angst of Highway 61 Revisited and bringing it all back home were blown wide open to reveal Pure Freak, it's rock's first double album monument, where the distance between Dylan's imagination and his music entirely collapsed. "The closest I ever got to the song I hear in my mind," he famously said, "that thin, that wild mercury sound." With its chain lightning mix of rock and roll, novelty music, surrealistic ballads, Chicago blues, and psychedelic country, it peals of lyrical invention and epic song lengths. Blonde on Blonde might seem like the kind of work that involved long-term contemplation. In fact, most of the album was knocked out between stints on the road during a historically intense bout of touring. In the fall of 1965, Dylan wanted to continue pushing his new song and tour with an electric band. A decision was made to split a series of upcoming concerts between an acoustic set and a plugged-in performance. At the suggestion of his manager Albert Grossman's secretary, Dylan checked out Canadian band The Hawks, who had cut their teeth backing rockabilly singer Ronnie Hawkins. Dylan was especially impressed by Robbie Robertson, the band's 22-year-old guitarist, and asked the Hawks to play 2 shows, one in New York and one in L.A. At the New York show, held in front of a crowd of 14,000 at the Forest Hills Tennis Stadium in Queens, fans sat patiently through Dylan's acoustic songs and then commenced booing during his electric set. Some people sang along to Like a Rolling Stone and then booed when it was over. After they completed their West Coast date, the Hawks, soon to be renamed The Band, were hired for a year of shows that began in Texas in September 1965. That October, just as the tour was beginning, Dylan and the band went into Columbia Studios in New York and recorded the single, Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window? A curt blast of Like a Rolling Stone-style acrimony Dylan was so pleased with that he once kicked folk scene grandee Phil Oakes out of a limo for saying he didn't like it. Surprisingly, though, more attempts by Dylan and the band throughout the fall and winter produced only one song that made it onto Blonde on Blonde, One of Us Must Know, Sooner or Later, a swirling haymaker that took 24 takes and had to be finished with the help of other musicians. Oh, I was really down, Dylan told writer Robert Shelton. Salvation came from a surprising place. The previous summer, during the end of the at times difficult sessions for Highway 61 Revisited, producer Bob Johnston had introduced Dylan to multi-instrumentalist Charlie McCoy, a seasoned musician from Nashville who played with everyone, from Elvis to Perry Como. After McCoy sat in on the recording of Desolation Row, Johnston suggested Dylan might like recording in Nashville. See how easy that was? Johnston said. Nashville was uncharted territory for rock musician. Grossman objected strenuously, but after the frustrating sessions with the band, a new approach seemed worth pursuing. Taking advantage of a short break in his touring schedule, Dylan traveled to Music City for a few days in February 1966. Johnston and McCoy convened a world-class lineup, including drummer Kenny Buttrell, guitarist Wayne Mott, pianist Hargus Pig Robbins, and guitarist-bassist Joe South. Dylan brought Robertson from New York, the only member of the band he invited, and trusted keyboardist Al Cooper. To create a more organic environment, Johnston had the partitions that separated the musicians from one another in the studio taken down and burned. I was only 22, recalls Cooper. It was the first time I had recorded outside of New York. Now I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. I didn't know the musicians personally. As I got to know them, I realized they were really nice people. It was a very comfortable situation for myself and probably Rob. When Dylan arrived in Nashville with his new wife, Sarah, and their one-month-old son, Jess, he had a few songs ready to go. The elegant fourth time around was a direct, albeit never acknowledged, reference to the Beatles' Dylan-esque classic, Norwegian Wood, with the lyrics, I never asked for your crutch, now don't ask for mine, possibly serving as a warning to John Lennon to stop ripping him off. Leopard skin pillbox hat was a hilarious snatch of a 12-bar Chicago blues that has long been rumored to be about Edie Sedgwick, reigning starlet of Andy Warhol's factory scene, who Dylan had been spending some time with recently. When asked about the song in 1969, Dylan said he might have seen a picture of one in a department store window. The album's first session would produce the apocryphal Visions of Johanna, which Dylan first debuted in 1965 at a Berkeley concert attended by Allen Ginsberg and Joan Baez, who insisted the song was about her. With Cooper's organ and Robertson's trebly guitar shadowing Dylan's lyrics, which go on for five image-stuffed verses, the song turns a recollection of a hazy New York night into a liquid meditation on carnal obsession and spiritual desire. At 7 minutes long, it also suggested this wasn't going to be just another series of recording dates. It was really far out would be the term I would have used at the time, said Bill Akins, who played keyboards on the song. And still today, it was a very out there song. As Dylan later said, I'd never done anything like it before. The song set the tone for the rest of the session. Dylan got down to writing new songs and called the musicians in when it was time to record. For the crack team of players, this was an entirely new experience. Accustomed to Nashville's sharp standards of professionalism and tight budgets, where a musician was rewarded for working quickly and the most efficient players might record a song an hour, they now found themselves being paid to be on call waiting for genius to strike. There were some days when he would sit in the studio for 6 hours and work on lyrics, says Cooper. We ended up getting there at noon and going home at like 5 or 6 in the morning. We'd get there at noon and wouldn't record anything until 4 or 5. Dylan concurred, saying in a 1968 interview, the musicians played cards, I wrote out a song, we'd do it, they'd go back to their game, and I'd write out another song. When they were summoned, the songs that awaited were unlike anything they'd ever played on. The day after recording Visions of Johanna, Dylan laid down another landmark epic, Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, which ended up stretching out past 10 minutes in the studio and took up the entire final side of Blonde on Blonde, an ode to Sarah Dylan. It started out as a little thing, as Dylan later recalled, but I got carried away somewhere down the line. We started Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, a 14-minute ballad at 4 a.m., McCoy recalled. And concentration is tough at 4 in the morning when you've been up all night, waiting to play, and nobody wanted to be that guy who messed up. But we did it, and after that, everything went much smoother. With his creativity peaking, Dylan began entertaining the idea that the album might become a double LP. He left Nashville for some concert dates and returned in mid-March to finish the song. The songs recorded during the March sessions were shorter and flowed faster than ever, with Dylan working on a piano in his hotel room and Cooper playing musical direct, taking Dylan's ideas to the session musicians to prep them so that when Dylan finally arrived with the finished song, they'd be ready. These sessions rendered a batch of classics, including Just Like a Woman, another likely ode to the star-crossed Sedgwick that stands as Dylan's finest ballad. I Want You, the curt, catchy tune that provided the album with its initial working title, and Rainy Day Women 12 and 35, a shambling processional that may have been inspired in part by Ray Charles' Let's Go Get Stoned, and became a number two single, despite, or because of, its overt drug allusion. As McCoy recalls, Bob Johnston came to me and he said, "Listen, later tonight he wants to do a song with a Salvation Army sound." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Oh, you know, some horns, a trumpet, a trombone." And I said, "Okay, does the trumpet need to be good?" He said, "No, no, it's Salvation Army." And I said, "Okay, I'll play trumpet." A couple of drinks, and it was done. After some final mixing in Los Angeles later that spring, the album was complete. Its cover photo, taken by Dylan's friend Jerry Schatzberg on a cold day in New York, showed Dylan dressed for winter in suede jacket and checkered scarf. Many took its blurry image to be a drug allusion, but as Schatzberg later recalled, "It was that we were outside, it was very cold, and we were shaking, both of us. That's really what it was, and that's how it turned out." If the photograph was truly accidental, it's the perfect image of Dylan at the time, creating in a heedless rush, too fast to stay in focus, even for a second. This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.